This talk was given by Danica Shoan Ankeley at the Zen Center of New York City. Shoan is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Shoan. I'm a monastic in this order, and I live mostly upstate at Zen Mountain Monastery. And then, with great gratitude, I have the opportunity to come down here periodically, once every 4 to 6 weeks or so, and practice with our city sangha. And it's been quite a week. And I felt it very keenly, you know, it's a trip I've made many times from the mountain into the fire of New York City. And I grew up in New York City, and I love it here. This place is also my home. And it is, you know, always a little bit of a transition to come from the Catskills into Brooklyn. But this week, I felt it in a whole nother level because I was so aware of, you know, the cloister and the refuge that the monastery is, and the bright, burning fire that is manifesting in the world right now, particularly with regard to our country's politics. And let me just say at the outset that, you know, I have my own particular political views, and this place needs to be a refuge for everyone. And so regardless of what your views are, you are welcome here. And if you practice in the Muslim faith, you are welcome here. And if you are an undocumented immigrant, you are welcome here. If you arrived in this country as a child and are protected under DACA, you are welcome here. If you're a refugee seeking asylum in this nation, you are welcome here. And if you have ever felt or feel now that you don't know if you belong here, welcome. And I'm aware that I'm echoing the words on kind of an inclusion statement that we have by our front door. And that was drafted by one of my Dharma sisters shortly after the 2016 election. And it bears repeating. Whenever we point to someone else and consider them the other, we have deviated and drifted off of the path of genuine Dharma practice. And so we should consider this, and I remind myself of this as I feel myself heated up by my own views and adverse to the views of others. So what I want to talk today about is the lifeline of Zazen, the refuge of practice, and turning to practice particularly when it's a time of difficulty or challenge for us. And of course, I'm kind of reacting to the news of the week, but this applies even just in the news of our day-to-day life, the challenges of having a relationship, going to work, paying the bills, getting along. So what does meditation practice have to do with our crazy states of mind and when we look out what may seem like our crazy world? You know, and whether we understand this craziness in terms of a political climate or whether we understand the craziness of our own stuckness, or our own inability to change or blossom or transform. In both ways, there is a lifeline offered to us to something deeper, something true, something real. there is depth available to us that can hold all of this and that is untarnished and untainted by the craziness. And that depth is in each of us, and we can find it in each other too. I came down to the Zendo to sit on Thursday night or Friday night, I'm not sure which, and was feeling very filled. One of the things that happens when I come to the temple is I have unlimited, unregulated access to the news. And so I always get a little bit drunk on like 24-hour Wi-Fi access because I don't have that upstate. And so you can imagine it definitely, you know, at a time like this, I'm like reading. I'm discovering new sites I never even knew existed and kind of falling into that, what can sometimes feel like a black hole of perspectives and views and opinions and concern, very deep and very real and very justified concern. And so I came into the Zendo and was kind of asking of myself this question, like, what does this have to do as I take my seat and we dim the lights and we turn inward in this practice of silence and stillness? What does this have to do with the burning world outside the doors? And I had this image come to me of someone throwing a line, a lifeline, overboard, you know? And that Zazen can be that contact with our real nature, with what actually makes our life meaningful, with the true wisdom of reality, our undeniable, irrefutable, absolutely pervasive connection with one another as human beings. Zazen can be a doorway to that, a lifeline. And so whether you call it reality or God or goddess or truth or love or the mystery, the ineffable, the great matter, we have to stay in contact with that. And I was speaking with one of my Dharma sisters this week, and she was talking about joy and the role of joy in her own practice and saying, you know, sometimes I think in Zen there's kind of a language problem because we speak about awareness, we speak about concentration, we speak about mindfulness, and we don't necessarily make that connection to joy. And I thought, ah, this is so what I need to hear right now, and I wanted to offer it to all of you. That is absolutely correct. When you are really in touch with your life and your direct experience, the possibility of joy opens up. And it's not joy like everything's great and everything's rosy and things are working out how I want them to be. It's a whole different quality of experience that is grounded in just direct contact. It's grounded in aliveness. It's you touching in with the mystery of you. And this is really what our life is about. So even as we, you know, live through turbulent times, or as I'm sure many of you did yesterday, you know, put on our walking shoes and go join our brothers and sisters in a protest, it's so important to stay in contact, in direct contact with our actual life, with our sensations, with our feelings, with each other, with things, the material world, because that's an avenue of nourishment and sustenance. And that's, again, opening a doorway to our actual Buddha mind. And so while Zazen is, and mindfulness practice is an excellent way to calm the mind, and during periods of agitation or stress is an excellent way to let go and center, really, it's also offering us something greater, which is what I want to remind us of and myself about. A reminder of this lifeline of practice and the transformative power of practice also came as I was just down here earlier in the weekend when another Dharma sister showed me a photograph. She had been looking for news reports about the protest in DC on Thursday, women protesting the family separation at the border, and had come across this image that I think is from the original Women's March. It's an awesome image. It's the Capitol building in the distance, the avenue flooded with humanity and those pink pussy hats. And front and center, this is just an image that appeared, I guess, in The Hill, like one of Washington's newspapers. In the front and center of the image is a woman holding up a sign. And if you look really closely, there's a sea of signs, but hers really stands out because the whole image is kind of centered around it. And it says, "Rise up, woman. No mud, no lotus." And boy, was it great to see that sign, you know, and feel like, oh, right. Thank you, sister, for that reminder just when I needed it. And also, like, we're out there. That's the importance too of like showing up. If you are someone who goes to demonstrations and protests, you know, there may be a cynical part of you, or you have cynical friends that think, what's the point of this? And you know, the point of it is that we need to feel each other. We need to see each other. We need to know that we're not alone. So this no mud, no lotus within Buddhism, you know, there's the teaching, the lotus is a symbol of enlightenment. And the metaphor is, and you know, here we use it in the liturgy, the lotus that blossoms in the muddy water, that is completely dependent upon that muddy, murky water to flourish, to blossom, and emerges from the water untainted, with none of that, you know, murk or mud on its leaves or petals, but is just perfect and radiant, and uses the mud, uses that muddy water to thrive. No mud, no lotus. So how do we make that true in our own life? Using the mud of our life, of our circumstances, as the very grist of our transformation. When we say, you know, nothing sticks to the lotus that emerges and is pristine, what is that? That to me is an interesting teaching, because, you know, when we think about, well, what does it mean for something to stick to us? Or for us to stick to it. And we use this language all the time. In Buddhism, we speak of clinging. So, you know, reflecting on it, I was thinking like, oh, there is a way that an entrenched view, right, when we're not open, when we're unable to hear, unable to listen, that entrenched view, that's a stickiness, a heaviness that burdens us. If we're obsessed about something, you know, that kind of clinging, again, it takes our mind, or we take our mind and, you know, wrap it around a thing and lose contact with that deeper truth, with our real life, with that sense of connection and genuine belonging. If we stick to a dependency on a specific outcome, right? We need things to be a certain way. That is also sticking, clinging. So how do we practice as moral beings with a moral compass and work for the good and not get stuck in there? That is an open question. I don't have an easy answer, but I did think about it, and I found a awesome passage from Rebecca Solnit, an essayist, her book, Hope in the Dark. So she says, hope locates itself in the premises that we don't know what will happen, and that in the spaciousness of uncertainty is room to act. When you recognize uncertainty, you recognize that you may be able to influence outcomes, you alone or you in concert with a few dozen or several million others. Hope is an embrace of the unknown and the unknowable, an alternative to the certainty of both optimists and pessimists. Optimists think it will all be fine without our involvement. Pessimists take the opposite position, and both excuse themselves from acting. Hope is the belief that what we do matters, even though how and when it may matter, who and what it may impact, are not things we can know beforehand. We may not, in fact, know them afterward either, but they matter all the same, and history is full of people whose influence was most powerful after they were gone. What spoke to me so powerfully in her words was her conviction, which is completely in accord with the Dharma, that what we do matters. And we hear about it all the time in different contexts, that the reverberations of a single action cannot be contained and cannot ever be fully known. And so when we turn ourselves toward the light and manifest good, we may or may not see any result of that in the present moment. And we have no idea the effects of that and how they will reverberate. But it is a karmic law that goodness reverberates in goodness. This is really important. It means that whether we consider ourselves the kind of person who's going to go out and protest, or whether we can just be kinder to our neighbor, those actions have an effect. They matter. They matter. The Buddhist precepts, the foundation of the Buddhist precepts are the three grave precepts. They're sort of holding the whole universe of activity. They are: do not create evil, practice good, and actualize good for others. And in the precept ceremony, if you've ever been there for one or received it yourself, the teacher will, you know, offer words on that. And more than once, I have heard the teaching rolled out that, like, really, that's all you need is those three basic precepts, which are just different ways of saying manifest goodness. Do not create evil. Practice good. Actualize good for others. That's the whole thing. So if you're like driving the engine of your life and using those to navigate, that's powerful. Whether it's in a small way or whether you have, you know, the national stage, it doesn't really matter. So rather than depending on a specific outcome, right, and Solnit talks about that we don't know actually what will happen, So helpful to be reminded of that when you're like inundated by pundits who are saying this is what's going to happen. We don't know what will happen. This is not a time to be, like Pollyanna or, foolishly optimistic. But it is a time to appreciate that we are influencing reality. There's a story that I heard years ago, and it's such a, I may have even told it in a talk. For some reason, it really stayed with me, and there was a senior student from New Zealand. We have a sangha in New Zealand, Jinman, who was giving a talk at the monastery, and he talked about he was out to breakfast. Daito Roshi was in New Zealand, there for a stay, offering teachings, and a group of them went out to breakfast, and they were sitting in the window of a cafe. And the traffic police came by and started to write out a ticket because I guess the car was illegally parked or something. And Daito Roshi turned to Jinman or one of the other people at the breakfast table and said, "Oh my gosh, go out there and do something. We're about to get a ticket." And Jinman told the story. He said, "In New Zealand, we're like not really confrontational. People were sort of like, no, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, Roshi." And Daito was like, no, go. We're about to get a ticket. And they were like, no, it's fine. We'll just pay it. No big deal. Da, da, da. And so Daito was kind of like, okay, whatever, and let it go. And they went on having breakfast. And Jinman's point of telling the story was that he realized afterwards that it hadn't happened yet. And that in our sort of the way that we fool ourselves, that like, it's okay, it's no big deal, we don't want a confrontation, the thing hadn't happened. It was possible to influence the outcome. And for some reason, that story, even though it's sort of like trivial, has really stayed with me. Because I think it points to something true and important. So to drink from the well of practice of Zazen and to appreciate that we can't measure our practice, we can't really know in this exact way how an action reverberates with our Zazen, the same is true. We can sit down, and I remember for years before I moved into the monastery full time, I would be like, it's such a waste to sit right now. My mind is so busy. I'm just going to sit there being like, da, 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 forget it. I'm just going to watch a movie or like have a dish of ice cream or check something off my to-do list. And now I appreciate so much because I have to, take my seat when the time comes. That's part of the beauty of the monastic schedule, whether I feel like it's going to be a good period of Zazen or not. And you learn from that like you don't know and you're really in no position to judge your practice. How we act and how we live matters. Being generous matters. Being fierce matters. Asking ourselves what we can do and doing that, stretching ourselves, has an effect. It matters. There's a teaching in the Vimalakirti Sutra of about Buddha fields. So we should practice in such a way that we make our life a Buddha field. What does this mean? We have to find out what it means going beyond the words. Living is actually a creative act. We are creating our life with the choices we make and how we approach our life. And so that's why it can be so powerful to see into our mind, seeing what we're doing. We're empowered to do differently. James Baldwin, in a talk he gave at Community Church here in New York City in 1963 on the artist's struggle, spoke to this, what's the meaning behind the words. He said, "I really don't like words like artist or integrity or courage or nobility. I have a kind of distrust of all those words because I don't really know what they mean any more than I really know what such words as democracy or peace or peace-loving or warlike or integration mean. And yet one is compelled to recognize that all these imprecise words are attempts made by us to get to something which is real, and which lives beyond the words. Whether I like it or not," he goes on to say, "for example, and no matter what I call myself, I suppose the only word for me when the chips are down is that I am an artist. There is such a thing. There is such a thing as integrity. Some people are noble. There is such a thing as courage. The terrible thing is that the reality behind these words depends ultimately on what the human being, meaning every single one of us, believes to be real. The terrible thing is that the reality behind all these words depends on choices one has got to make forever and ever and ever, every day. I'm not interested, really, in talking to you as an artist. It seems to me that the artist's struggle for his integrity must be considered as a kind of metaphor for the struggle which is universal and daily of all human beings on the face of this globe to get and become human beings." There is such a thing as a Buddha field. There is such a thing as courage. There is such a thing as beauty, as belonging. What is it? Practice gives us a direct line to find out for ourselves, to do that work of becoming an actual human being. It gives us a way to make those choices that have an effect, that absolutely matter, which are creating the stuff of our life and of our present reality. And those choices cannot be contained. There is such a thing as good. There is. What is it? Who are you? What is courage, really? How can we bring it alive in a way that is real for us, not somebody else's idea, not comparing ourselves to someone else, not measuring or judging, that's true, that we know for ourselves directly is true? Authenticity. There is such a thing as authenticity. What is it to actualize good for others? Maybe that means you run for office. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the counterpoint, the bright light in the news. I was watching a snippet of the Colbert Report in my late night internet interlude. And he asked her, she considers herself a democratic socialist, and he asked her about democratic socialism. And she said, "In a modern, moral, and wealthy society, no person in America should be too poor to live." So, to find that lifeline, to let ourselves be nourished and sustained and lifted up and working for the actual good, discovering the unity the great mystery of this human experience. The love that pervades the universe. There is such a thing. Joy matters. And life is a spiritual experience, meaning transformation is a natural part of being a human being if we don't block it. And joy is there and can be there even in a struggle. It's all about contact. Zazen is a lifeline that's offering us a deep teaching and ongoing training on how to make real contact. We have to realize it for ourselves. It's up to each one of us. You came in this door this morning. I'm so grateful for your company. Your presence here matters. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. The monastery's quarterly journal, Mountain Record, has a new home at mountainrecord.org. For over 30 years, Mountain Record has been offering spiritual seekers of all faiths a unique journey through words and images. Each quarterly issue delivers a thought-provoking array of classic teachings, contemporary wisdom, stunning photographs, and news from the Mountains and Rivers Order. For more information, to subscribe, or to read our open access articles, visit mountainrecord.org.